This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Not That Bad, Dispatches from Rape Culture, edited by Roxane Gay. With essays written and read by me, Roxane Gay, Aubrey Hirsch, Jill Christman, Claire Schwartz, Lynn Melnick, Brandon Taylor, Emma Smith-Stevens, AJ McKenna, Lisa Meekum, Vanessa Martyr, Ali Sheedy, XTX, So Meyer, Nora Salem, Liz Lenz, Amy Jo Burns, V.L. Seek, Michelle Chen, Gabrielle Union, Liz Rosma, Anthony Frame, Samita Mukhopadhyay, Miriam Zoila Perez, Zoe Medeiros, Charisse Tracy, Stacey May Fowles, Elizabeth Fairfield Stokes, Meredith Tallison, Nicole Boyce, and Alyssa Bassist. For every person who has been scarred by rape culture and survives nonetheless. Introduction. When I was 12 years old, I was gang raped in the woods behind my neighborhood by a group of boys with the dangerous intentions of bad men. It was a terrible, life-changing experience. Before that, I had been naive, sheltered. I believed people were inherently good and that the meek should inherit. I was faithful and believed in God. And then I didn't. I was broken. I was changed. I will never know who I would have been had I not become the girl in the woods. As I got older, I met countless women who had endured all manner of violence, harassment, sexual assault, and rape. I heard their painful stories and started to think, what I went through was bad, but it wasn't that bad. Most of my scars have faded. I have learned to live with my trauma. Those boys killed the girl I was, but they didn't kill all of me. They didn't hold a gun to my head or a blade to my throat and threaten my life. I survived. I taught myself to be grateful I survived, even if survival didn't look like much. It was comforting, perhaps, to tell myself that what I went through wasn't that bad. Allowing myself to believe that being gang raped wasn't that bad allowed me to break down my trauma into something more manageable, into something I could carry with me instead of allowing the magnitude of it to destroy me. But, in the long run, diminishing my experience hurt me far more than it helped. I created an unrealistic measure for what was acceptable and how I was treated in relationships, in friendships, in random encounters with strangers. That is to say that if I even had a bar for how I deserved to be treated, that bar was so low it was buried far below ground. If being gang raped wasn't that bad, then it wasn't at all that bad being shoved or having my arm grabbed so hard it left 5 bruises in the form of fingerprints or being catcalled for having large breasts or having a hand shoved down my pants or being told I should be grateful for romantic attention because I wasn't good enough and on and on. Everything was terrible, but none of it was that bad. The list of ways I allowed myself to be treated badly grew into something I could no longer carry, not at all. Buying into the notion of not that bad made me incredibly hard on myself for not getting over it fast enough as the years passed and I was still carrying so much hurt, so many memories. Buying into this notion made me numb to bad experiences that weren't as bad as the worst stories I heard. For years, I fostered wildly unrealistic expectations of the kinds of experiences worthy of suffering until very little was worthy of suffering. The surfaces of my empathy became calloused. I don't know when this changed, when I began realizing that all the encounters people have with sexual violence are indeed that bad. I didn't have a grand epiphany. I finally reconciled my own past enough to realize that what I had endured was that bad, that what anyone has suffered is that bad. I finally met enough people, mostly women, who also believed that the terrible things they endured weren't that bad, when clearly those experiences were indeed that bad. I saw what calloused empathy looked like in people who had every right to wear their wounds openly and hated the sight of it. When I first came up with the idea for this anthology, I wanted to assemble a collection of essays about rape culture. Some reportage, some personal essays, writing that engaged with the idea of rape culture, what it means to live in a world where the phrase rape culture exists. I was interested in the discourse around rape culture because the phrase is used often, but rarely do people engage with what it actually means. What is it like to live in a culture where it often seems like it's a question of when, not if, a woman will encounter some kind of sexual violence? What is it like for men to navigate this culture, whether they are indifferent to rape culture, or working to end it, or contributing to it in ways significant or small? This anthology became something far different from what I originally intended. As I started receiving submissions, I was stunned by how much testimony writers offered. There were hundreds and hundreds of stories from people all along the gender spectrum, giving voice to how they have suffered in one way or another, from sexual violence, or how they have been affected by intimate relationships with people who have experienced sexual violence. I realized that my original intentions for this anthology had to give way to what the book clearly needed to be: a place for people to give voice to their experiences. A place for people to share how bad this all is. A place for people to identify the ways they have been marked by rape culture. As of this writing, something in this deeply fractured culture is, I hope, changing. More people are beginning to realize just how bad things really are. Harvey Weinstein has fallen from grace, named by a number of women as a perpetrator of sexual violence. His crimes have been laid bare. His victims are, at least to some extent, vindicated. Women and men are coming forward and naming sexual harassers, or worse, in publishing, journalism, the tech world. Women and men are saying, this is how bad it actually is. For once, perpetrators of sexual violence are facing consequences. Powerful men are losing their jobs and their access to circumstances where they can exploit the vulnerable. This is a moment that will hopefully become a movement. These essays will hopefully contribute to that movement in a meaningful way. The voices shared here are voices that matter and demand to be heard.
Fragments by Aubrey Hirsch. He says, "You shouldn't wave those around like that. You're in the campus dining hall with your friend James. You've just popped a rust-colored birth control pill out of its slot in the rubbery blue envelope. You say, 'I wasn't, I was just taking one.' He says, 'You should take them in your room, by yourself, privately.' 'I have to take them with food,' you say, 'or they make my stomach hurt.' 'It's been that way since you were 15 and you first started taking them. That was years before you actually have sex, and, even when you do, you're so afraid of getting pregnant accidentally that you don't let a man come inside you until after you're married. You take them because your period is a terrifying beast. The hormones gallop through your veins. You wake up in the middle of the night, twisting, your stomach lurches, your intestines heave. The pills help. You don't like taking them every day, though. Even the smell of the blue rubber envelope makes you a little queasy when you dutifully pull them out of your purse at the same time every afternoon to sedate the beast inside." He says, "Still, you shouldn't let everyone see. You don't want some guy to see you taking those and think he can take advantage of you and there will be no consequences. You put the pill on the back of your tongue and the envelope back in your bag. James watches as you bring your water glass to your lips. You swallow. Hard. If rape culture had a flag, it would be one of those boob inspector t-shirts. If rape culture had its own cuisine, it would be all this shit you have to swallow. If rape culture had a downtown, it would smell like Axe body spray and that perfume they put on tampons to make your vagina smell like laundry detergent. If rape culture had an official language, it would be locker room jokes and an awkward laugh track. Rape culture speaks in every tongue. If rape culture had a national sport, it would be, Well, something with balls, for sure. You drink too much at the party because it's college and you're always drinking too much. The party is terribly generic, with beer pong and a bass-heavy soundtrack. Everyone is drinking foamy beer out of red Solo cups. You think there might even be a blacklight somewhere. Daniel knows you don't drink beer, so he has brought you a bottle of cheap vodka, which you drink mixed with even cheaper orange juice. You flit around for a while, talking to one group of people, then another. A boy in the kitchen, a baseball player, takes his dick out to show everyone how big it is. It is, in fact, very big. The last thing you remember is lying down on the couch. Just to close my eyes, you think. Just for a minute. When you wake up, you are in a bed in an upstairs bedroom you have never seen. Daniel is in the bed next to you. Your clothes are on, but your shoes are off. "Hey," you say, pressing into your temples. Maybe if you press them hard enough, the pounding will stop. "You fell asleep," he says, before you even ask. "I carried you up here." You say, "You carried me?" "Yeah, I didn't want to just leave you down there with all those dudes, passed out on the couch like bait or something." "Did you take my shoes off?" "Yeah, so you could sleep." Your mouth feels dry. Everything is blurry. You rub your eyes and take in a breath so you can thank Daniel when he says, "I took your contacts out, too." You don't know where your gratitude goes, but suddenly, it's gone. These stories aren't worth telling. There's no arc to them, no dramatic climax. There's nothing at stake, not really. You imagine your listener leaning in, and then what happened? And you have to say, "Nothing. That's the whole story." "Oh," she says, her mouth a firm line. These are little bits of things that happened, or things you think about. They're light on tension, you know that. There's no real peril. There's no resolution. Still, they stick with you. You think about them, even after they're over. Sometimes for a long time. Sometimes for a very long time. That's how you know they're important somehow. It's why you can recall the smell of that party, even many years after the smell of your grandfather's cologne has faded from your memory. When you become a writing instructor, eventually, you end up with stories about rape stories. The first story is a rape story on purpose. A student hands it in for a fiction assignment in the composition class you are teaching. In it, the hero finds his petite brunette English teacher alone in a church. He pulls out a 24-karat gold-plated gun with a pearl handle, holds it to her head, and rapes her, bending her over the back of a pew. When he's finished, he drives off in a convertible and leaves a bag of money at the police station to avoid arrest. You are the petite brunette English teacher. You're only 22, just a few years older than this student who now sits in your office with his hat pulled down over his eyes. You're too timid to call him out on this threatening, misogynistic bullshit. What if you're wrong? What if he complains to your boss? What if he gives you a low score on your teaching evaluations? Instead, you critique the story, which isn't hard. It's a horrible story. The hero is unlikable, and the ending is ludicrous. You say all this to your student as he smirks beside you. "And look here," you say, a slip in verb tense. "Here, a comma splice." In the second rape story, the hero meets a girl at a party. She's beautiful, drunk, glassy-eyed, and nearly incoherent. When she's no longer able to walk, the hero, who hasn't had anything to drink, carries her outside, to the beach. He strips off her clothes and has sex with her while she makes soft, moaning sounds. Then he dresses her again and lies beside her on the sand. "The tone is a bit confusing," you tell your student when he comes in for a conference. "It seems romantic, almost. Are we supposed to feel sympathy for this character, even as he's raping her?" The student looks taken aback, surprised. "He's not raping her. They're having sex." You point out all of the evidence that he is, in fact, raping her. She's clearly very drunk. She can't even walk by herself. She never takes any agency, just lies there while it's happening. The student cuts you off. This is, like, based off me hooking up with my girlfriend for the first time. It hadn't occurred to you that the student might not have realized he was writing a rape story. All I can say, you say, is that a lot of people are going to read this as rape. But it isn't, he says, weakly, sounding more like he's trying to convince himself than you. It wasn't. The third story comes to you in a creative nonfiction class. The narrator gets very drunk at a party. She kisses one guy, and another kisses her. She runs away and bumps into an acquaintance who she barely recognizes through the haze of cheap beer. He is aggressive, putting his penis inside of her while she tries to stammer, "Wait, wait." You start the workshop by asking your students to give a quick summary of the piece. Someone offers, "It's about a girl who goes to a party and gets drunk and hooks up with a bunch of dudes." Interesting. Does anyone have anything to add or a different read? The students shake their heads. Well, you offer, I think this first part is a hookup, and the second part may be a misunderstanding, but I read this last section pretty straightforwardly as being assault. All of the students look down, rereading the last section. Some of them tilt their heads, as if to say, The essay never uses the word rape, but it does say wrong. It says wasted and sick and dizzy and vomit. It says ignore. How is it possible they haven't seen this? How is it possible they are learning about consent from their teacher? The author of the essay is forbidden to speak by the rules of the workshop, but you study her as she takes notes in silence. Did she know? You wonder. Does she know now? You recognize the tension between I am a body and I have a body, but you are unable to resolve it. Have implies that this body is just a possession, that it can be lost or thrown away, that you can do without it. It implies, perhaps, that someone else could have your body, and that your body would not be your own, that it would belong to another. That doesn't feel quite right. But am doesn't seem right either. To be a body suggests that you are only a body. You are meat and some blood. You are hard bones and flexing cartilage. You are tangled veins and skin. Is that all, though? You stand in front of the full-length mirror on your closet door and take inventory. Here are your knees. There are two of them. Two elbows. A chin. A torso with breasts that are heavy with milk. Feet, hands, knuckles, two earlobes, 10 toenails, several dime-sized bruises, thousands and thousands of hairs. There are things you can't see, but you know they're there. Two lungs, a liver, the stacked cups of your backbone. Your heart you saw once on an ultrasound machine. Your womb you've seen 4 times, but never when it was empty. Nerves, ball joints, the intricate pleating of your brain. It is a long list, but also it is not so long. Looking at it now, you wonder, isn't there more to you than that? Sometimes people tell you that you're lucky that you have sons, so they won't have to deal with all this crap. It's true that your kids, by virtue of both being boys, will be in a privileged position, but the idea that they won't have to deal with rape culture makes you shudder. You very much want them to deal with rape culture, the way one deals with a cockroach problem. Sometimes you think about what you'll tell them and come up surprisingly blank. It's the words that fail you, not the ideas. The ideas are there. Though you aren't sure exactly what you'll say, these are the things you want them to know. It's not okay to hit the girl you like, and it's not okay to hit the girl you love. The world around you tells women that they should always nod politely, no matter what they're feeling inside. Don't ever take a polite nod for an answer. Wait for her to yell it. Yes! Not everyone gets sex when they want it. Not everyone gets love when they want it. This is true for men and women. A relationship is not your reward for being a nice guy, no matter what the movies tell you. Birth control is your job, too. Don't ever use an insult for a woman that you wouldn't use for a man. Say jerk or shithead or asshole. Don't say bitch or whore or slut. If you say asshole, you're critiquing her parking skills. If you say bitch, you're critiquing her gender. Here are some phrases you will need to know. Practice them in the mirror until they come as easy as songs you know by heart. Do you want to? That's not funny, man. Does that feel good? I like you, but I think we're both a little drunk. Here's my number. Let's get together another time. Your cousin texts you out of the blue to say, I just got raped at the bank. Oh my God, you respond, are you okay? Your brain goes turbo. You are trying to imagine which hospital she's at, if she's likely to press charges, why she's reaching out to you, and what you can possibly do to make this any less devastating. The flashing ellipsis appears on your phone to signal that she's typing. Then it turns to words that you struggle to focus on. Yeah, I deposited my check in the wrong account, so I've been overspending on my debit card. I got like $175 in fees. You watch for the ellipsis, but it doesn't appear. After a moment, you realize this is the whole story. By I got raped, she meant I got charged bank fees for overdrawing my account. You stare at your keyboard for a while, with its letters and exclamation points and frozen-faced emojis, and then you put your phone away. You can't think of a single thing to say. Jordana has invented a new kind of rape prevention underwear. If she orders a batch of 5,000 pairs, she can manufacture them for $2.25 per pair and wholesale them for $4 per pair. If she orders 10,000 pairs, she can manufacture them for $1.90 per pair and wholesale them for $3.50. Given these figures and assuming no import taxes, how will she get the rapist to wear them? Mark leaves work at 6:25 every evening. Moving at a steady 6 miles per hour, he walks 11 blocks north, 3 blocks west, and 1 block south to get to his apartment. On his way home, he passes the diner, where Gina works. When she works the afternoon swing shift, she leaves work just before Mark passes by. She walks 8 blocks north at an average speed of 5.5 miles per hour. Now that it's wintertime and starting to get dark, how far behind Gina should Mark stay so that she won't be afraid he's coming to attack her? Carla is editing her online dating profile. When she adds the word cheerleader, her message requests go up by 11%. When she changes her body type from average to thin, her message requests increase by 42%. When she lists feminism as an interest, her message requests decrease by 86%, and the number of rape threats she receives triples. Assuming she goes on an average of 3 dates per month, how many hours will she need to spend with any given man before she feels comfortable giving him her home address? A child is raped in Montana. The rapist is 31. The child is 15. The age of consent is 16. The punishment for statutory rape in Montana is 2 to 100 years in prison and a fine of up to $50,000. If, however, the rapist is only sentenced to 30 days in jail and no fine at all, how much older than her chronological age must the child have been behaving when she seduced him? This is your new thing. When a man yells at you on the street, you yell back. You are tired of pretending you can't hear these men. You are tired of gluing your eyes to the sidewalk in shame. You are tired of taking it, of treating it like a tax you must pay for the privilege of being a woman in public spaces. You think, perhaps foolishly, that you can explain your feelings to these men, and they will listen. You wear your resolve like armor, and it doesn't take long for you to get a chance to put your plan into action. You are leaving the store, a plastic bag of groceries dangling from each hand, when a man walking behind you says, "Hey, hey, hey, you are beautiful." You stop walking and he passes you. It's now or never. You say, "Can I talk to you for a second?" He stops to face you, about 3 feet away. "Why did you say that to me?" Instead of answering, he just tries his line again. "Hey, beautiful girl. Can I tell you something?" He doesn't answer, but he doesn't move away. He seems confused, like when you push a floor button on an elevator and the doors don't close, so you just keep pressing it. "Why aren't you shutting up? This isn't what's supposed to happen." You say, "When you say that to me, I don't feel flattered. I don't even feel angry, honestly. I feel afraid. Did you know that?" "Why? Why are you afraid? Afraid of me?" "Yes," you say. "When men like you yell stuff at me on the street, I am afraid that you will hurt me." "Oh, I'm scary. Is that what you're saying?" Now he moves. He takes a big step toward you and, damn it, you flinch. You say, "Yes," trying to plate the word in steel, but it crumbles in your larynx like tinfoil. You start walking to your car. He follows you the whole way, shouting, "Now I'm scaring you, huh? Now you're afraid of me." He's right. He is scaring you. You are afraid. But there's something new, too. Before this, you really thought maybe these guys just didn't know how their comments made people feel. You thought maybe they were trying to be nice. But now you know the truth. They know it makes you feel frightened. They like it. There's still fear, yes, but now there's anger, too. So much anger that it boxes out some of your fear. The next time you yell back to the man yelling at you, it's easier. And the time after that, it's easier still. Now the responses roll off your tongue like perfect round stones. You've worried them in your mind and in your mouth until they are smooth as glass. "Why would you say that to me? That's an offensive thing to say. It's hurtful to talk to women like that. You should never say that again." Your prize for all this effort is a small thing, but you cherish it. It is the astonishment on your harasser's face. Sometimes he even mutters a flimsy, "Sorry," before he hurries away from you. He doesn't want a conversation. He's not shouting at you as a method of engagement. He's just testing something out. He needs to fumble around for his power in the dark, like a totem he carries in his pocket. He wants to make sure it's still there. Next time, you tell yourself when it's done, this man won't shout so readily. Next time, he will see the woman coming, open his mouth to speak, and for 1 second, one perfect second, he will be afraid of her.
Slaughterhouse Island by Jill Christman. The thing about telling this story even 30 years later is that even though I know where the culpability rests firmly, I have trouble soaking off the most dogged shame. I am scraping away the last of the sticky residue with my thumbnail. Yes, I did some stupid things. We all do. But now I know we're allowed to be kids who mask our gut-deep insecurities with vanity. We get to wear crop tops and tight jeans with a ribbon of lace for a belt and high-heeled boots. We get to check ourselves 10 times in the dorm room mirror, necks craning to see how fat our skinny little asses look from the back. And we even get to guzzle sweet drinks and swallow harmless-looking tabs we hope might make us feel better, or dance faster, or look prettier, or just forget. We get to want something to come easy for a change. We get to make every choice on that daily life scale from forward thinking to utter self-sabotage. And we still don't deserve to be raped. Not ever. How did we ever get to a place where victim blaming was wedged so far into our brains? Turn this around, I think to myself, scraping with my thumbnail. Turn this around. What would Kurt have had to do for me to feel justified in raping him? There's no answer to that question. I want to fold time. I want to walk into that Italian restaurant in Eugene, Oregon, where my 18-year-old self is having her first awkward date with Kurt. Take her by the hand and ask her to join me in the bathroom. Instead of letting her throw up the 4 bites of creamy pasta she ate for dinner, which I know is all she can really think about as she watches Kurt's pointy teeth flash in the candlelight, I want to pull her around the corner, hurry down the hall in the opposite direction, and make for the exit. We'll leave together. I'll walk her back to the dorm, and we'll have a talk. I'll save her somehow from what's going to happen to us next, even though, sweet girl, I know it's not your fault. None of this was ever your fault. Do you hear me? Not your fault. But from here, back in the future, I can only watch. You drive a Porsche, rhyming with borscht, without the final T, I'd said, after I'd lowered myself down onto the soft leather of Kurt's sleek silver car, hoping my friends on the second floor of the freshman dorm were peeking from behind the curtains. He'd leaned in toward me, breath too minty, already thinning dark hair glinting with product in the spring sunshine, and moved his large hand from the gear shift to my thigh. I think he was trying to look sexy, but managed instead to look maniacal. Porsche, he said. People who don't have Porsches call them Porsches. People who drive Porsches call them Porsches. I moved my knee a fraction, the tiniest of objections, and said, well, I don't have a Porsche, so I'd better call it a Porsche. You're with me now, he said, thin lips curling into a smile. Now you can call this car a Porsche. I hadn't had a date like this before, what I imagined to be a real college date, during which Kurt picked up, moved, or lifted everything that might need picking up, moving, or lifting. The door to the Porsche, my chair at the table, my body by the arm when another man came too close, and of course, the check. We went to a real sit-down Italian restaurant with white linen tablecloths, candles, and dim lighting, where we talked about the extensive time he and I both spent at the gym on the edge of campus, me in aerobics classes, burning away any calories I'd consumed in moments of weakness, and him lifting and slamming giant iron discs in the testosterone soup that was the main gym. We were both too tan, this being the era of 10 tans for $20 in the warm booths on the campus strip. I was in my first year in the Honors College, reading Darwin and Shakespeare and Austen, having my mind blown by Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and theories about sexual selection and how the universe began. Kurt was in business, a super senior. The first I'd heard such a moniker, though it didn't take me long to figure out that the super didn't mean anything good. Since we had nothing else to discuss, the conversation turned to tanning. I told him how I always fell asleep under the lights, the humming blue womb offering respite from the gray Eugene winter, although I'm sure I wouldn't have said womb, not that night. And Kurt's teeth glowed in the dim candlelight like something out of a horror movie. After dinner, Kurt took me back to an apartment that looked like nobody lived there, gave me something to drink, and led me through the living room with its black leather couch and glass coffee table into his bedroom. Closing the door behind him, he showed me the hand weights he kept in a line by the wall, like shoes, and then pushed me toward a desk. I remember his hands, always on my body, and even before he pulled the mirror and the razor blade out of the center drawer, I was thinking, this isn't good. Kurt reached into the pocket of his coat and pulled out a paper packet, druggy origami, tapping two snowy piles onto the glass. I watched him chopping and scraping, wincing a bit at the sound, a fork on china, nails on a chalkboard, a warning alarm I would fail to heed. Down to the roots of my nerve fibers, I knew the thing to do was get out. But this was to be a night of many college firsts. First restaurant date. First ride in a Porsche. First blow. Kurt rolled a crisp green bill from his wallet and showed me what to do. It burned. And then, not much. The coke had done nothing more than make my eyes feel really, really wide open. I would be hyper alert for what came next. Which was also almost nothing. He kissed me, and as he did, he pulled me away from the desk and down onto the bed. He was the world's worst kisser, all probing tongue, like a sea slug trying to move down my throat. I was repulsed, but saved, I know now, by the coke. Kurt couldn't get it up. He rolled against me and through the thin fabric of his dress khakis, I could feel him against my thigh, soft as a dinner roll. George Michael sang through the speakers, Rather than pursue what he must have known from experience was a losing game, Kurt sprang from the bed as if he'd planned it that way and went to the stereo to turn it up. I will be your father figure. 30 minutes later, when I asked for a ride back to the dorm, he gave me one without much of a fight in the Porsche. The next day, apparently having had more fun than I had had, Kurt called to ask if I'd go with him to Shasta Lake, an annual Memorial Day fraternity tradition at the University of Oregon. At least 100 rented houseboats, each carrying 8 or so couples, kegs tapped and flowing, red solo cups bobbing in the water like buoys. Imagine the drinking and the drugs. Imagine the sleeplessness and the unfinished brains. Imagine the heat, the dehydration, and the food packed by the boy men hosting this nightmare. Imagine that nobody on the whole boat had the sense to bring sunscreen. Imagine the depth of seething, unmet need. And then, imagine the depth of the water. Imagine, too, that I'd already made plans to go with a friend from my dorm, a guy named Jeff, who had pledged a fraternity the previous fall. Stretched to his full height, Jeff reached only to my nose. But he was clever and made me laugh, so when he'd quite casually offered to bring me along to Shasta, I'd agreed. But a real invitation from a real date, with a real car and a real apartment with real furniture, seemed like just the kick and status I needed to go from full scholarship hippie kid with Beatles posters and batik bedspreads stapled to the walls of her dorm room to what? What did I want to be? Part of the system my liberal artist parents had always rejected, noticed, accepted, desired? I didn't even like Kurt. He represented everything I'd been taught to distrust in the world, a privileged fuck from the burbs who thought anything could be his for the right price, including me. So at first I did the right thing. I said no to Kurt, but my best girlfriend, Dee, had not gotten a date for the lake trip, and I felt bad leaving her behind. Also, I didn't want to go on this trip as a lone independent, an honors college student, a veritable freak in a vast Grecian sea with Jeff as my sole companion. So when Kurt's frat buddy agreed to take Dee on the trip with us, if I would go with Kurt, I consented. And then all hell broke loose. When I told Jeff I was going with Kurt instead, he flipped out. His room was just below mine, and all night he played angry music and hung out his window, screaming that I was a bitch, a whore, a fucking cunt. Other boys from the dorm joined Jeff in his righteous fury, smashing things against the floor, pounding on my door, and hissing through the crack. I didn't get mad back. I felt terrible and guilty, cowering in my room while the whole male population of my dorm rose up with a clear message. I had belonged to them, and I had strayed from the pack, hooking up with a rogue male and threatening the sanctity of the whole goddamned dormitory gene pool. All night, I took in their anger, crying so hard and so long without the good sense to take out my contact lenses that in the morning, I had to have an emergency appointment with the ophthalmologist. My corneas were both scratched, one eye so badly I had to wear an eye patch. I was a sea wench who had survived the shaming, but barely, and there was no turning back now. I would go to Shasta as a pirate with Kurt. We hadn't even left the dock before it was obvious that Dee's companion wasn't much of a date. They weren't even speaking to each other, but she didn't care. She may as well have been on another boat, lost as she was in drugs, Jack Daniels, and the eyes of a new friend with whom she was swaying near a boombox, hitting rewind on a worn Eagles cassette, Desperado, locked in as their song. By the time Kurt and his pack of drunken brothers, baked in every way there is to be baked, anchored our boat on Slaughterhouse Island in the middle of Shasta Lake, the deep water was not just a metaphor. On the roof deck in my magenta bikini, I felt alone and trapped. The fraternity brothers on the boat assigned all the girls nicknames for the weekend, and mine was Carcass. Kurt hovered over me. I knew it was too late to get away, and somehow I knew what was coming. I don't know how many white houseboats docked on our side of the island that night, at least a dozen. After the sun had set, fires sprang up, the music got louder, and voices rose in a discordant roar. I'd refused the coke all day. That night in Kurt's apartment had been enough for me. But when the party was raging, Kurt pulled a baggie out of his pocket and held something out to me in the palm of his big hand. brown mushrooms like shrunken heads on tiny necks. I took a few and chewed the tough, dry stems, washing them down with a slug from his beer. When the mushrooms started to kick in, I slipped away from Kurt and the hordes of drunken Greeks, climbing the bare slope where the dark, swaying shapes of human bodies circled the flames, pushing through some thick brush near the top, and finding shelter next to what seemed at the time to be a fantastically magnanimous scrub pine. From my refuge, I watched the bonfires burning red, a post-apocalyptic hellscape, the moored houseboats bobbing like a flotilla of crocodiles. I was well hidden, and far below, I could see Kurt moving from boat to boat, up and down the bank, looking for me, screaming my name, yelling, "Where is she? Where the fuck is she? Who's she with? Who'd you see her with?" I was with nobody, alone on top of the hill, and I knew when I came down I would be caught, so I stayed under the tree. 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. The mushrooms wore off, and I was tired and so cold. When I finally didn't see him anymore, I crept back down to the boat. This was my thought. If I am in bed and sleeping when he finds me, maybe he will let me sleep. I will sleep until tomorrow when the boat will return to the dock and I will be safe. But when he found me, I was not safe. They will wake you up to rape you. The next morning when the boat docked, Kurt walked up into town and came back with a paper bag of Dunkin' Donuts, cream-filled, jelly-filled, powdered and plain, at least 2 dozen, and he said to me, "Here, Jill, you get first choice." 6 hours before, he'd had a pillow stuffed in my mouth to muffle my screams, and now he had the nerve to give me first choice on a bag of fucking donuts. I wondered then if I could have fought harder. I hadn't bit off his earlobe and spit it into his face. I hadn't jammed my knee into his testicles with all the force of my starved 18-year-old body. I hadn't leapt to my feet and rammed a well-placed heel into his kneecap. I pleaded. I cried. And finally, I screamed for help. But I didn't hurt him back, because I didn't want to die. I remember the pillow in my face, and when there wasn't enough air left for screaming, thinking, "Breathe, breathe, breathe." In the bright morning sun, Kurt looked hideous. The bag of donuts hanging in the air between us, the smell of hot sugar over stale beer and vomit all around us. His eyes registered nothing, nothing at all. And I imagined clawing them out. "No, thank you," I said, turning away. "I don't eat donuts." When we got back from California, Kurt called me on the dorm phone in the hall again and again. Here's what I didn't say. "You fucker, you raped me. You think I'm going to go out with you?" Here's what I did say. "I'm busy, and I can't, and I have to work, write a paper, do some math." I didn't call what happened on the boat that weekend rape. And then, a month after Shasta, I agreed to see Kurt. I had a ticket out of Portland to fly to Savannah, Georgia, and I needed a ride to the airport. Kurt wanted to be that ride. What harm could come of it, I thought. Some nice boys from the Honors College, actual friends, got me as far as Portland and offered at least 10 times to take me from the bookstore where we were hanging out to the airport. They didn't know what Kurt had done to me, but they knew I didn't like him. Why did I let Kurt come and pick me up? I still can't answer that question. "Jill, it's so good to see you," Kurt said when he pulled up to where I was standing by the curb with my suitcase. "I've missed you. Have you missed me?" He tried to kiss me, but I turned my face away. Kurt unlatched the tiny trunk, wedged in my suitcase, and then putting his hand on the small of my back, guided me to the passenger side of the growling car. As soon as I was in, I noticed something hanging from the rearview mirror, something familiar. "Hey," I said, "that's mine." "Yes," Kurt said, touching a finger to the loop of white lace knotted around the base of the mirror. "Your belt. I wanted something to remember you by." I reached up to snatch down Kurt's trophy, but he stopped my hand and squeezed, leering. Finders keepers. As the Porsche pulled away from the curb, I felt a wave of loathing and fear. Kurt took the wrong road out of downtown. "Where are you going?" I asked. I forgot something at my parents' place, he said. We're just going to swing by on our way to the airport. But it's not on the way to the airport. I knew Kurt was living with his parents in the suburbs. It's fine, he said, grinning. You've got plenty of time. At the house, I wanted to wait in the car, but he said I should come in and meet his parents. They weren't home, of course, and somehow we ended up in Kurt's bedroom. He closed the door. What are you doing? I said. I have to go. Kurt put his face close to my face, the aftershave, the mint, all of him sickening to me. We were in a kind of dance, me backing up until I hit the edge of the bed. Kurt smiled. He put his hands on my shoulders and pushed me down. I landed flat on my back and he fell over me, pinning me down with his body. Again, no, 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 it was going to happen again. Then we heard something, someone coming in the door. Kurt jumped off me and reached down, offering me his hand and pulling me up. I was in shock. I said nothing. There was nothing left for me to say. Kurt laughed. What did you think I was going to do, Jill? Rape you? In his own terrifying way, Kurt had named his own crime before I could, and yet I never filed a report. I never even said, you raped me. I did nothing. I got out of that fucking car at the airport, and I never saw him again. In the bunk on Shasta Lake, Kurt had put a pillow over my face so no one would hear me scream. But now I wonder, who would have heard me? And if someone had heard, on that boat anchored to an island I didn't know until today was named for an actual meat market and slaughterhouse, who would have acted? Who would have helped me? From the distance of nearly 30 years, my heart made vulnerable by motherhood and my fierce desire to protect my children, I wonder, how many other women were raped that night on Slaughterhouse Island? I feel certain I was not the only one. In Savannah, the summer after the rape, I had sex with more different men in 3 months than in all the years before and all the years after combined. My unarticulated logic went like this. If I give my body away, over and over, I can prove to myself that sex is my choice. Even though, and this seems significant now, I always let the men choose me. Until I was 19 years old, it never occurred to me that I could do the choosing. Not you, not you, not you. Yes, okay, you. The morning I wrote this essay, I went to my bookshelf and hooked a finger over the red spine of a paperback. I never called it rape. The cover is designed to look as if part of the book has been ripped away, and the pages of my copy are browning on the edges. Published in 1988, the very year I went to Shasta with Kurt, reporter Robin Warshaw's book revealed the results of Mary Koss's Ms. NIMH-funded survey. Theirs was the first nationwide study of campus sexual assault ever, and the statistics rattled us all. 25% of women in college have been the victims of rape or attempted rape. 84% of these victims were acquainted with their assailants. Only 27% of women raped identified themselves as rape victims. I bought the book as a senior when it was a required text for a class called Self-Defense from the Inside Out. Holy shit, I thought then. Why didn't anybody tell me this before? Here in the pages of I Never Called It Rape, I can have a conversation with my college self. She wrote, not a lot, in purple pen, scratching asterisks next to the things that mattered most to her. 1 in 4 female respondents had an experience that met the legal definition of rape or attempted rape. And the average age when a rape incident occurred, either as perpetrator or victim, was 18 and a half years old. And women were embarrassed about the details of the rape, leaving a bar with a man, taking drugs, etc., and felt they would be blamed for what occurred, or they simply felt the men involved had too much social status for their stories to be believed, and, in short, many men fail to perceive what has just happened as rape. The question, our self-defense teacher said one afternoon when we were gathered around her cross-legged on mats in the gym, is not, what will he think of me if I don't answer his question, if I'm not polite, if I don't want to go, but what do I think of him? This simple rearrangement of pronouns flipped something in my brain forever. If a guy on the street approaches you and asks for the time, our teacher said, you don't have to answer him. Providing the time of day is not your job. If you don't want to talk to him, keep walking. You don't have to be polite. You don't even have to be nice. Keep walking. Ask yourself, what do I think of him? 3 years after the rape, I began volunteering at a local sexual assault support organization, staffing the crisis line, and going with a team to talk to high school students about rape. In 1991, conversations about what constituted true consent were still new, and while the boys sat silently, the girls pushed back. So you're saying that if I go to a party in a really short skirt and I'm flirting all over the place, if I get raped, it's not my fault? Yes, I'd say. That's exactly what I'm saying. Sometimes it seemed to me that the girls just didn't want to hear that rape is never the victim's fault. They wanted to have something to believe in, rules to follow, a formula, reasons other girls got raped and they didn't. Short skirt equals rape. Too much beer equals rape. Unlocked door equals rape. The part I wanted them to understand is that these equations can implode, constricting your whole life, until one day you're sitting in a locked steel box, breathing through an air hole with a straw, and wondering, now? Now am I safe? A couple months before the rape, a truck had hit me. It wasn't a big truck. One of those little ones, a Toyota or a Nissan with a canopy on the back. I was riding across the crosswalk on my bike. I knew I was supposed to walk my bike across, but I had the green light and the white walking man, so I'd started to zip across when the man driving the truck, not seeing me, made the decision to turn right on red. I went down hard, but I was wearing a helmet, and though the truck didn't stop right away, it did soon enough. My legs and half my twisted bike were under the bumper. When I wriggled free, I felt nothing in particular until I saw the horrified, worried face of the man emerging from the cab, the two women running from the building across the street. Oh my God, are you okay? Are you okay? A car stopped behind the truck, and more people, whose sexes and sizes have been lost to memory, got out. Lying on the cold, wet road, I was surrounded by concerned bystanders. I did feel something. Mortification and shame. My arm and leg on the pavement side were both bleeding, but I hadn't been dressed for the weather or for biking. I was coming back from a class at the gym, so I was wearing a sweatshirt and black Lycra pants. Ruined now, I thought. Shit. Are you okay? Everybody seemed to be saying the same thing over and over, and I was worried they were all going to get really wet. It was March in Eugene, with drizzle so thick and gray and constant, I couldn't tell whether the raindrops were moving up or down. I must have been in shock. Are you okay? Yeah, I mumbled, grabbing for the bumper and pulling myself off the ground. Hands all around, but I reached out for none of them. I'm fine. I'm okay. Somehow we all got to the sidewalk on the other side. My bike had a twisted rim and was unrideable. Are you sure you're okay? Can we help you get somewhere? No, I'm fine. My dorm's right over there. I'm fine. And so everybody left, even the little truck that had flattened me. And I thought over and over, I feel like I've been run over by a truck. In fact, I had been run over by a truck, but I couldn't say that out loud. I couldn't say how much it hurt. Embarrassed by being in the wrong place at the wrong time and the wrong pants, I limped back to my dorm in the rain. Do you understand yet why we blame ourselves when we are hit, dragging the shame behind us like a twisted rim? In 2014, psychologists at the University of Oregon conducted the first comprehensive university-wide survey of sexual assault and learned that 19% of female students are victims of rape or attempted rape during the time they're studying at Oregon. 19%. 1 in 5 women. Today. I am still scraping at my story. I can't go back and get the young woman I was from the Italian restaurant before she climbs onto the boat. I can't stop the truck or the rapist, but I can let the girl I was know that I see her. I hear her. I know she is telling the truth. If nothing changes, and in 30 years, not nearly enough has changed, next year, there will be 100,000 more assaults on our campuses. One is too many. 100,000. In the self-defense class, our teacher taught us that if we couldn't imagine doing something, cracking an assailant in the head with a stapler, opening up a can of pepper spray on an attacker, digging our keys into the eyes of a would-be rapist. We wouldn't be able to act in a real crisis. Wielding the stapler, the pepper spray, and the keys, our teacher taught us the power of visualization, and I learned to imagine in advance what I might be called upon to do in an emergency. 100,000, this is an emergency. Together, let's visualize what we need to change the rape culture. I have my keys in my hand, and I am holding them like a claw. Let's turn this motherfucking system around.
And the Truth Is I Have No Story, by Claire Schwartz. I, too, having lost faith in language, have placed my faith in language. Terrence Hayes. 1. This is not about that. This is about everything after. This is about how, all of a sudden, there was only one after. How the infinity of tiny afters, after school and after my most recent birthday, and after A and I ducked behind a couch hiding from nothing and she told me she was falling in love with me, and after my chest opened to a new kind of wanting, and after I last had a fever, and after the first time I threw a frisbee without its careening into the ground, were all swept away into the only after that stretches out endlessly over the unfolding nows. This is about that. My language is so imprecise. I am thrashing in what I can't tell you. Like how people north of Pennsylvania say the city like there was only ever one, and it is, of course, New York. No Newark, no Hoboken, no New Haven, no Boston, no Providence, no Portland. Just New York, dressed in its sparkling lights and beautiful people, its bright red scarves and head wraps and food carts recklessly jettisoning the aroma of gyro and bagels and tacos and pad thai across it all. I hate New York, I usually say when the subject comes up, meaning maybe. How could any city that flaunts its beauty like that let this happen to me? Though I know all cities eat their own. And this is not about the city. 2. You're so lucky you weren't killed, the first person I tell tells me. I am a sophomore in high school, and she is an English teacher and my advisor. I have moved to Manhattan from Nashville. I want to go home to my grandparents and my cousins, to the city whose heartbeat and language I know. My teacher is still talking. There's a bug in her hair. I watch the bug slowly climb the mousy blonde strands and wonder how I am supposed to respond to her comment. I'm silent. The bug inches on. That evening, in line at the grocery store, I watched the slim, middle-aged white man in front of me calmly hand his brie to the cashier. I imagined tapping his shoulder and saying, "Oh, what luck. It's wonderful that you're not dead." When I laugh at my own thought, it sounds like I'm trying to dislodge a stone from my chest. The brie buyer looks at me. I become engrossed in the gum beside the register. You're so lucky you weren't killed. The words feel slender and sharp as the blade that was pressed against my neck that night, stroking a border so fine you can touch it and touch me at once with each of its cool metal faces. You killed. 3. At least you weren't killed. At least you have access to medical care. At least you have insurance. At least you have wonderful friends. Because the ones who tell me this are my friends and my teachers and the social worker and the doctor, I hold their words in outstretched hands, even though my anger is mounting and I want not to be touched. These days I speak few words, and I certainly don't have the vocabulary to dismantle what's been forced on me by people called safe. I don't have breath to say, "No, I will not be grateful for my rights.
I will stand with 2 feet on this earth, and I will always say thank you when someone does something kind, and sorry when I've done something wrong, and never outside of that. And yes, I am furious that I am pulled between poles of gratitude and apology, both of which are violent erasures.